This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. The Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence released the hashtag InAgainstDA campaign earlier this week. And we're joined now by the coordinator of prevention initiatives at the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Colleen Yackel, to talk about the campaign. So to start with, first, thank you so much for joining us, Colleen. What is this campaign exactly, and what are the initials standing for here?
Yeah, thanks, Miriam. Thanks for inviting us to participate. So the campaign is about really addressing the stigma surrounding domestic violence to better enable survivors to reach out for support. We developed this campaign because we conducted a series of interviews with survivors of domestic violence from all walks of life, from all over Indiana in 2018. So that we could better understand their needs and their priorities for services and support. And these survivors were different in so many ways, age, ethnicity, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, abilities, just different in so many ways. But what they all had in common was this experience of judgment when they tried to reach out for support. They told us that they were judged for the decisions that they made about their relationship. And really, they were judged in all directions. Some of them were told that they should have left sooner. Some of them were told they should have stayed longer and tried to stick it out and make it work. So they felt like that judgment was a significant barrier in their ability to reach out for support and assistance. And that those feelings of judgment and shame reinforced their sense of isolation, which is so dangerous for victims of domestic violence, reinforced their feelings of isolation, but also the sense that they are at least partially to blame for their experiences of abuse and violence. So we created the campaign really to invite in greater understanding of the dynamics of domestic violence and greater compassion from all of the community members that surround survivors of violence and can be available to support them.
Now, is there a difference when you refer to this as either domestic violence or domestic abuse, or is it the same thing?
Well, I think domestic violence is the term that is most recognized because it's the term that we've used in the movement for the past 45 or so years that there's been an organized domestic violence movement in Indiana. But we use the broader term domestic abuse to embrace the fact, to recognize the fact that domestic abuse takes many forms. It isn't just physical. It can be emotional, psychological, mm-hmm. sexual, economic. And survivors tell us that all of those forms of abuse are very serious and that they hurt. So we want all survivors to know that we recognize their experiences and that we are available to offer them support. I think the term violence has felt exclusive to some survivors, and the images that we've used historically in awareness campaigns of physical injury leave a lot of people feeling left out.
Right, right. I'm just imagining, you know, if a lot of folks see that domestic violence, or they imagine that it's physical and they don't understand there's a mental component that you might not see bruises. It's more on a psychological level.
Right.
Well, how do you combat, like you're mentioning about how a lot of these survivors feel judged and they've, you know, been on the receiving end of people saying things to them like stick it out or you should have left sooner. How do we as a community combat that kind of attitude?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're working to do is to really help the community better understand the complexity of the issue, because I think we've all been involved in some degree of oversimplification, including those of us in the movement. When we've done work around awareness, we have defined safety in pretty concrete and straightforward terms, right? Safety has meant leaving the relationship, usually using domestic violence program services, some form of those, shelter or other services, and involving law enforcement. And we know from survivors that those solutions don't work for everyone. The decisions that they make are incredibly complicated. You know, leaving is not a simple experience. It's a process for most survivors that requires time, resources, support, transportation, many things. So leaving is complicated. Also, we know that only about 50% of domestic violence survivors choose to contact law enforcement. So the solutions that we've offered haven't worked for a lot of survivors. So we want the community to understand that survivors make sound decisions about their experiences. They're the experts on their own lives and their own safety for themselves and their families. So we really want to help people understand the complexity and to validate survivors' decisions. Mm-hmm.
Well, when it comes to this campaign specifically, what are you focusing on, or is this just all encompassing?
Well, the campaign specifically includes voices of survivors. So we worked with survivors extensively to develop the campaign and used their words to say things that they would like to say to the people in their lives that care about them, about their experiences. So survivors' voices saying things like, you don't have to fix it, just don't turn away. It's not that simple. It wasn't safe for me to tell you. Will you be there when I need you? Things like that, that survivors want to say to their loved ones. And then the second component of the campaign are common things that bystanders say about domestic abuse that are kind of things that they say to excuse not being so helpful. So things like, I don't know how to help, or I didn't see that it was going on, or shouldn't you just leave? So things like that, just to really introduce those conversations. And the campaign connects back to the website to do a couple of things, to provide greater information about the complexity of the issue, but also to equip bystanders, community members, to help connect their loved one who's experiencing abuse to supportive services in their local community. Because that's what survivors told us they need. They need a compassionate, caring response, and then they need help connecting to resources. So we want to make that very easy. The web landing page provides multiple links that connect you to a statewide map of domestic violence programs and services, which are available throughout the state of Indiana, that can connect people with caring professionals who are prepared to answer questions, provide support, do safety planning, all of the things to really wrap around a survivor and the people that care about them and just offer information and support.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Now, you mentioned bystanders, and I'm curious to know, why is it important to focus on bystanders when you're doing this campaign, not just the survivors?
Well, I think historically, a lot of domestic violence awareness campaigns have given advice to survivors. And again, when that advice is kind of oversimplified and doesn't fit their lives, it's not advice that that they are necessarily able to take action on. And like we said, previous campaigns have involved a lot of images of injury, and survivors have told us that those things can be really triggering and traumatizing. So we want to offer compassionate messaging that can affirm survivors' experiences so they can see themselves and their voices in those experiences and feel very affirmed. But really important to address bystanders, because survivors reach out to bystanders many, many times as they are making decisions about their relationships. I believe I've heard a statistic that nationally a survivor will reach out 11 times while they're making the decision about what they need to do next. And the nature of the response that they get is so determinative about what happens next for them. If they reach out to a parent or a faith leader or a work colleague, and that person says, you know, why didn't you just some version of that? They shut down for a while and they are afraid to reach out again because they've been told that their decisions are wrong.
Right.
So we really want to help bystanders recognize that there aren't right decisions around how you handle an abusive relationship. There are many decisions, and providing survivors with support and information and supporting them while they find their path to safety is one of the best things that we can do to enable them to make connections.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. You mentioned that survivors will reach out about 11 times to figure out what to do. And I just wonder often if a bystander or somebody they're reaching out to isn't aware that that's what they're trying to do. And I don't know if there's a is there's some kind of tip you can provide, like if somebody's reaching out to you and they are trying to make a decision, what's the best thing that you can do?
Well, if you're uncertain, you can always ask. Mm-hmm. Feel free to ask, how can I be helpful to you today? I want to be helpful to you. So just ask. Sometimes survivors are just processing through it, thinking about their options, thinking about safety, thinking about their community's reaction, and maybe just your compassionate listening is all that's needed. But survivors tell us also that when they reached out, it would have been great if that person knew about resources and could help get them connected to help. So a couple of ways to go. And I think the best way to determine the response is just by letting the survivor guide the interaction. I think another important thing that bystanders sometimes get wrong in our zeal to be helpful is we take over and we tell the survivor what they need to do for their safety and their future. Also not so helpful. Our solutions may not be a good fit for their life. They might not be feasible. They might not be safe. So don't take over, but offer options, offer kindness. Those things, they don't always feel very significant to us, I think, just to offer our compassion and listening. But survivors tell us they are fundamental to everything they're able to do next.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, anything next that you're working on once this campaign is out and running?
Well, we just continue to work with programs all over the state to do everything we can to get survivors connected to supportive resources. We know we've seen over 100% increase in domestic violence homicide in the context of the COVID pandemic. So isolation is bad for us, and judgment contributes to isolation. So we can continue to try to connect survivors with resources, services, and supports. And while we're doing that, we're also working on the front end to try to promote supportive, connected communities that really prevent violence from happening in the first place. So doing that work on the state level and also across local communities to work to prevent violence from happening in the first place.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Colleen. Colleen Yackel is the coordinator of prevention initiatives at the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. After the break, we'll be joined by a professor of psychology to talk more about the bystander effect. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we spoke with one of the leaders of the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence's newest campaign, #InAgainstDA. We learned a little bit about bystanders and what they can do during situations of domestic violence. Now we're joined by Catherine Borschuk, professor of psychology at Indiana University South Bend, to tell us more about the bystander effect. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Welcome, Catherine. Thank you for joining us. I want to talk about the bystander effect, but first I want to get into sort of maybe the definition or the idea of it. We hear about it in different contexts, but how does it apply to domestic abuse?
Hi, Miriam. We've been hearing a lot more about the bystander effect in recent years. And just to define it right off the bat, it really refers to the fact that people will sometimes witness a situation that requires intervening, but they don't, in fact, do anything to help. So the idea behind the bystander effect is that people just stand by instead of standing up and getting involved. And it's an effect we've seen throughout history all over the place in lots of different situations. And the solution to prevention of and solution of many social problems is to, in fact, overcome the bystander effect and make upstanders out of bystanders.
Mm. So when you say that there's a history of the bystander effect, is that just part of human nature that there are folks who are hesitant to speak up?
Yeah, that's interesting. We don't know that this is really part of human nature or personality. We tend to think in my field of social psychology that it's more of a situational thing, actually, that there are a number of things that are happening in my immediate environment that might lead me to stand up for somebody, or in fact, might lead me to not stand up and just to be a bystander. And that can happen very often as well, that people can historically, that they can see something happening and walk away. And we don't really think that this is a human nature thing. We think we can create conditions under which people will be much more likely to intervene to help other people.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm wondering if for some folks, let's say somebody else is a survivor of domestic abuse and they see something and it's so triggering, they just can't get involved. Could that be a situation like that?
Yeah, what we see more often, though, I think, is that people who have been in a situation want to reach out and help others. We know that having difficult situations in one's past can actually help us to develop empathy. And the development of empathy is definitely implicated in bystander intervention, in intervening to help others. So although I do understand that one can be triggered by something, what we do have, I mean, the very first people involved in the movement to protect and to provide safety for survivors of domestic violence were survivors of domestic violence, started sort of, if I understand the history correctly, kind of an underground railroad sort of movement way back before the shelters existed, to keep people safe, to move women and children along to safe houses. And this was a movement begun by survivors of domestic violence themselves, not necessarily by people in the social work profession or outside. Eventually, that became more of an institutionalized movement. But the whole movement to bring to the public's attention the fact of family violence in general was, I think we can credit survivors for that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the culture has changed also? Like, I'm just thinking maybe like 100 years ago versus now, where certain types of behavior were tolerated and now it's like that is actually abuse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, things have changed a great deal. I teach a class on domestic violence and we go into a little bit of the history of domestic violence. I mean, into the laws that were written several hundred years ago was, for instance, the rule of thumb, which determined that a man could beat his wife with a piece of stick or wood no larger in circumference than the length of his thumb. So it was one of our first rules or first laws that tried to restrict domestic violence, tried to put a limit on how badly a wife could be beaten. And that's where we get the rule of thumb from. Obviously, we've had a profound change in laws. A lot of those have been during the movement that Colleen talked about over the last 40, 45 years or so. For instance, I'm just thinking about the law against marital rape was fairly recent in Indiana. I think it was in the 1980s. That's definitely a type of domestic abuse that wasn't even necessarily against the law in all states fairly recently. And also, I think we are starting to talk about domestic violence a little bit more. And that's certainly part of the program that the coalition is working on, is to get the word out and to get people to feel comfortable enough with this issue. I often have my students do a report, a conversation report, where they just talk to people in their communities, whether it's relatives or an aunt or a next door neighbor, and say, what do you know about, what do you think about domestic violence? Does it happen here? And they're often shocked with people who say, we don't talk about that, or on the converse, oh, that happened to everybody I knew when I was young, but we still don't talk about it, right? So I think part of the movement here of the coalition's program, new program, is to get people to feel like it's okay to talk about this. In that sense, the stigma will hopefully be lessened, and that is their goal, is to reduce the stigma.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we keep hearing this word stigma, especially when it comes to things like domestic abuse. And I wonder why it carries such a stigma if there are so many resources now that weren't available, let's say, even 20 years ago. What is it that keeps this stigma going?
I think part of it is just the role of stereotypes. For instance, we believe that marriages and relationships are private, not public events, because the question is always raised, if somebody punched somebody at work or was stealing passwords or key information or financial stuff from somebody at work or a neighbor or a friend, that person would call the police. It would obviously be seen as a crime, whereas our communities have struggled more to see what happens in the home as a crime, partly because this misapprehension that what happens privately is between a couple. Within that family, it's not really anyone else's business. And that's part of the reason that folks don't speak up. They don't say anything. They don't wonder, are you okay? Because that's their business. They're married. They're a private couple. We actually have some experimental research that shows if a woman is running down a hallway in a university yelling, leave me alone. Why are you bothering me? I don't even know you. People are more likely to intervene than if she yells almost the exact same thing. Leave me alone. Why are you bothering me? I don't want to go out with you anymore, or something like that, implying that she knew this person who was bothering her. Folks are much more likely to get involved if they believe that these people know each other, if they believe there's an ongoing relationship. Just this sort of privacy that surrounds the family that we can see has really worked to be harmful to a lot of survivors and child abuse survivors as well. We don't want the state. We don't want the neighbors. We don't want the police in the sanctity of the home. That's sort of a misapprehension. And it's a stereotype that anything that happens in the home is not of our business. And it's led to all kinds of cover-ups of terrible things. Mm-hmm. Another stereotype, I think, is just a typical gender stereotype that in a heterosexual relationship, there should be a man who's in charge and makes all the rules. This is obviously a very old and patriarchal idea upon which our society, Western culture, was founded. And there are many who still buy that, who still do believe the man is head of the home, therefore he gets to make the rules. And if we're talking about a heterosexual relationship in which the male is being abusive, and that's not always the case, I will say, but if we are talking about that, then people won't get along, maybe won't get involved and won't talk about this because that's just how it's supposed to be. Women are supposed to be submissive and obey. So these are very old gender stereotypes that also, I think, work to keep people feeling a little hesitant from getting involved in a relationship situation where there's some type of abuse.
Right, right. And I think it's hard with some of these stereotypes that have been around. Like, I can think of just my own growing up and going to school and hearing these things, and they're slowly changing. But I mean, there's generations of us that have heard a lot of these stereotypes that it's going to take a lot of time to change. But when it comes to when we're talking about sort of the bystander effect, What is it that somebody can do to remove themselves from being a bystander? Like, you find yourself in this situation, instead of freezing and not doing anything, how can they actually take action?
Yeah, that's the question. And we do know a little bit about this from the research that's happened. We know that there's in the what we would call the bystander effect literature, there's actually a 5-step model that talks about how we can encourage people to get involved. And this all comes from research, experimental and other kinds of research, field research, that looks at why people don't get involved. So really the 5 steps are, the first thing we need to do is to notice that something is happening. Now, it might be easy to notice bruises on someone's face, but very often, as Colleen said, in domestic violence situations, the abuse is such that there are not visible bruises. Maybe we hear many, many accounts from survivors that their abuser knew how to even do physical violence in ways that didn't leave marks, or the domestic abuse could be very emotional, psychological. It could be happening in sexual ways, other ways that wouldn't be so obvious. So we have to find ways of noticing that something's going on in a relationship. The things we can look for are all sorts of red flags, such as somebody becoming isolated from their peers and family, or is being encouraged to isolate themselves, somebody changing their patterns of everyday life so that they don't interact with people outside the home anymore. That can often be a red flag. For younger people, it's a little bit different. When we talk to college students, there's other signs and red flags that we have to have everybody be able to notice that something is going wrong in this relationship. But then the second step is you have to interpret it, diagnose it as something that's problematic, something that actually needs help. This person may need help. And it may not just be somebody having bruises, as I said. It could be somebody being yelled at in public. It could be somebody who is becoming increasingly withdrawn. It could be somebody who seems to have recurring injuries that they try to explain away. It could be somebody who has no place to sleep sometimes. We'd need to be able to interpret or diagnose what's behind this person's difficulties or problems. Obviously, that's easier if we know somebody closely than if it's just somebody who's an acquaintance of ours. The third step is, and this is the very interesting part, is we have to decide that it's our responsibility. And this is the original research that the bystander effect was on, was why, I'm going to go back a little bit here for a second, if I can, back to 1964, when this research began because of the attack and murder of a woman in New York City named mm-hmm. Kitty Genovese. Many listeners might be familiar with her story. She was attacked, she was raped, she was murdered, she was stabbed in the easy vision, in the sight of many people in her high-rise apartment tower in the middle of the night. It was summer, pre-air conditioning, everybody's windows were open. Lots of people afterwards said, yes, they heard her screams. Yes, they knew she was in trouble. Yes, many had even seen her attack. But nobody had done anything, even including calling the police. That was the very first time we started talking about the bystander effect. This was a really big media story. And everybody in our culture asked the question, but why? Why didn't they help? Why were they bystanders? And the researchers who did the first original experiments because of the Kitty Genovese murder, they found that people didn't help because of something they called the diffusion of responsibility. And what that is means that you didn't help because you thought everybody else was helping. Mm-hmm. So we find that it's really important that people not diffuse responsibility. In fact, they have to say it's up to me. It's on me. I'm the one. In experiments, we find that if people believe they're the only person present at an emergency situation, they're very much more likely to help out than if they think there are two people or four people or eight people or 100 people. Somebody else will do it. It's very easy for us to tell ourselves. So we have to stop diffusing responsibility, and then we have to decide whether we have the skills to act. And this is where those resources that are going to be posted are going to be very helpful, that everybody will be able to look up, hey, what do you need and where can we find it? And then you have to actually engage and help. So that was kind of long-winded, but there are, in fact, five steps to turning a bystander into an upstander.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do remember that New York story, and I was actually going to ask you about that. So thank you for giving us the historical context there. I wonder, I mean, is there a way to encourage people to just say, you know, it's better to be over the top in your response and react to something than assume that someone else is going to take care of it? Or does that lead to its own set of problems?
We actually have some research on this and some training that does encourage people. There's all kinds of models of bystander training, mostly on college campuses and mostly having to do with sexual assault, but not all. Some have to do with hazing and sexual harassment in companies and other sorts of examples. But most of the research that we've seen on does training people to get involved under the right circumstances does lead to some kind of behavior change. Certainly leads to a lot of attitude change in that people know about the problem and are more likely to talk to others about it, thus lessening the stigma. So yeah, I think we do have some promising evidence. There's more coming out, but some promising evidence that training people to get involved, to notice, to interpret, to take responsibility and to act is in fact helpful.
Well, I'm also wondering about, someone once mentioned to me, you shouldn't always get involved because if you're calling someone out in public, let's say they're hitting somebody, and for that moment they'll stop, but then they're going to go home and really hurt that person. Is that a stereotype?
I think that what Colleen said about taking our lead from survivors themselves and people involved in the situation is probably the best thing. I think as an outsider, you can't really predict or determine what's going to happen or what types of things typically happen in private, but the survivor would be able to signal what's the best and most helpful thing to happen. We certainly do know that there have been folks in situations where they hadn't wanted to involve the criminal justice system because they worried about the retribution they might get for that, and that it could be worse. It's going to be different depending on every situation, and we really do have to follow the advice and the direction of the survivors in that particular situation. But asking, is everything okay? Is there anything I can do to help? I don't think you can go wrong that way. I've heard accounts and read accounts of people just needing a couch, a place to stay. And the first person who says, you can come home with me if you need to be safe tonight, started the chain of events that eventually got them out of an abusive situation. So you never really know. You could be the person who turns someone's life around, or you could be a step along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about a minute left. Any advice you have for folks who want to make sure they don't end up becoming a bystander?
Yeah. In this particular situation, I think it would do us all well to learn more about the facts about domestic abuse. I love the direction that the Indiana Coalition is going in looking at communities, because really, survivors of abuse and abusers themselves don't live in isolation. They work, they are in communities, they are in neighborhoods, they go to places of worship, they have families. And the more the folks around them are educated about the facts of domestic abuse, I think the better off we all are. There are those who are less likely to want to intervene, who are less likely to want to learn about this. And men tend to be less likely to be involved and interested and curious than women are. So I think we really could do a much better job reaching out to young men and talking to them about healthy relationships. In my experience, that's the best way to couch it, not to teach people, not to maybe run a workshop or a lunch program about how not to abuse somebody, but how to have a healthy relationship, because I think that's the goal for many folks. So I think that's something that we can do, is involve a lot more people, educate them about domestic violence, have them learn some of the red flags and warning signs about what it looks like if somebody is in a dangerous situation, and how to safely get involved and develop the empathy that they need to.
This is All In. I'm Miriam Soh. Before the break, we spoke with Catherine Borschuk, professor of psychology at Indiana University South Bend, about the bystander effect and domestic violence. We're going to switch gears a little bit here to talk more about this issue, but also to learn about the services and resources available here in Indiana. To learn more about that, we're joined by Linda Wilk, director of Hands of Hope, a division of Family Service Society Incorporated. Welcome, Linda. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we get into Hands of Hope and the work that you do, how big of a problem is domestic violence in Indiana?
I think it's something that it's hard to quantify, because as you have already heard, domestic violence takes so many forms. And so often police are not involved. No one is calling the police. And that's probably the best way to gauge, you know, what crime is taking place. So I think it's important to realize that even when law enforcement is called, it takes many incidents before that happens. And I like to say that any time in my area, any given day, law enforcement is responding to at least one case of domestic violence. So when you think about that, and you think about all that's underreported or not reported, it's very, very devastating. It's a very serious problem.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the pandemic, how did that shine a light on this issue? And did it impact domestic violence in any way, the pandemic?
It absolutely impacted domestic violence. Again, the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, in part of their research, found just how high the homicide rate increased during the height of the pandemic. I think the way it shed some light on domestic violence is people that normally are able to move about, you know, go to work, go to different events, they realized just how difficult it can be to live with someone you love, let alone someone that maybe is controlling you or is abusive to you. So I think hopefully in some ways it made people realize that, you know, it's not easy to leave, and how high tensions can become when people are unable to stay away from each other if they are finding that tensions are rising. So I think in a lot of ways it complicated and increased domestic violence. It also hopefully helped people understand a little bit more what might be going on in those relationships.
Right, right. Well, when it comes to Hands of Hope, what kind of work do you do?
I oversee the program. We serve Wabash and Grant counties. We have an emergency home domestic violence shelter where we can house up to 16 men, women, and children at any given time. While they are staying with us, we provide them with all their basic needs. So all their food, their safe clothing. We have a case manager that works with them. Again, works on what is it that they want to do. You know, they may just be looking for somewhere for a reprieve for a night or two to see what's going to happen next. You know, what's the abuser's next step going to be? We have outreach services. We're really trying to move more and more towards our outreach services, create more of a mobile advocacy program where, again, we are working with the victims in their homes, in their environment, finding out what it is that they want to do. So that may be, again, listening to them. It may be connecting them to free counseling, assisting them with filing paperwork for a protective order. It may be helping them find first month's rent or food or connecting them to other resources in the community that they were not aware of because they were isolated. We, you know, it's really all about how can we best assist a victim when they're ready and they directing what services we're providing to them.
Mm-hmm. And how was the work you were doing impacted by the pandemic? Were you still able to reach survivors or was it more difficult?
We were able to still provide our services. We still had the 24-hour crisis line. We still had our outreach services. When the governor, you know, had the shelter in place, we did have to close the facility. We did and would have had access to hotel stays if need be, but we were able to continue to provide the services we did pre-pandemic. I will say, though, we did not see a spike in the clients. I think, again, so many victims were isolated. They were being controlled. They couldn't reach out. They did not have an opportunity to reach out for help. So we almost saw really a decline in service in victims during that time frame, knowing that as things started to open up, then we would start to see the true ramifications of domestic violence and see the victims really come out mm-hmm. for assistance.
Is there any conversation in these organizations like yours on how to maybe change things if we had another situation where there's going to be a lockdown or something to make sure that survivors are reached? Are there any kind of alternatives come up with?
And one thing we, you know, found that Zoom can be very helpful, or, you know, just the electronic formats. So we're part of a large counseling agency, so we moved to telehealth very quickly. So again, I think it's all about how can we assist? You know, we have a text line as well as we try and keep up on our Facebook page and social media. So trying to find other alternatives to reaching victims and finding them and, again, providing those mobile services. They may not need safe shelter, may not be able to come to a safe shelter, but how can we safety plan with them? So as long as they're in that environment, we can try and help them mitigate, you know, the abuse. They know when the abuse is going to escalate. So how can we help them to stay safe during that time frame?
Mm-hmm. I wonder with survivors, is there ever sort of their own stereotypes? So we talked a little bit earlier about stereotypes and stigma that people have about folks that are in these situations, but survivors themselves that are directly in this situation, do they have stereotypes about getting help because it seems like it'll be a huge hurdle to have to overcome to find these resources?
I don't know if it's stereotypes. I know abusers are very, very good at manipulating and convincing their victims that no one will believe them, no one will listen to them. They are told that they're crazy. They're told that they can't do it on their own. They are financially limited because many times the abuser is controlling every aspect of their life, including the finances. We've had victims where the abuser will keep them high on drugs and alcohol because they know that that's how they can keep their victim there. So, you know, many times I think what we find is the extremes that abuser will go to keep their victim where they want their victim. So what we have to do is make sure that we are messaging, and that's why this campaign is so critically important, that we're messaging that we are there. We do care about you. We do believe you. We will listen to you. We will not judge you, because that's what the abuser is constantly telling them. And so we've got to break through that.
Mm-hmm. And so with Hands of Hope, how can folks find out about, I guess, the services that you offer?
We have a 24-hour crisis line, which we try and advertise in as many ways for as little bit of money as we can, because, of course, you know, that's always a barrier. We have ink pens that have our crisis line on it. We are trying our best through social media to get the word out. We try and, again, make sure a victim's more likely to go to someone that they know and trust to reach out to see if services are something that they can connect with that they can trust. So we need to make sure we're talking to our neighborhoods, to our churches, to our schools, to our businesses, you know, anybody and everybody that will listen to us. We have to make sure we're getting the word out, and we have to put resources with them. We have to make sure they have our crisis line at a minimum, so that, again, if someone discloses to you, or you think you might, you know, be working with someone that's being victimized, you can say, here is, you know, a phone call. Here is a place that you can call when you're ready, and we can offer the services or the support.
Mm-hmm. And do you mind sharing that number for our listeners?
Absolutely. 765-664-0701. And even if you're not in our service area, we will connect you to the service area, to the program where you are living. You know, the great thing about the internet, you know, you can be connected across the state, across the nation. You know, it doesn't matter. I don't want anyone to think just because, well, I'm not in Grand or Wabash County, you call us, we will connect you. We can do a three-way phone call so that we will, you know, continue to serve you until that other program is able to provide you with what you need in your area.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing to have that resource, and thank you for sharing that. I want to talk also a little bit about the Governor's Domestic Violence Prevention and Treatment Council, your involvement with that. What are you doing with that?
That's something I've been on for a very long time, and started out probably there was more grassroots features to it. Over the years, we've tried to always have a state plan in place where we're really, really looking at across the state of Indiana. What are the needs? What are survivors telling us? What are the priorities for funding? It's something that is critical. You know, we have funding that comes in from the federal level, through the state, through the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute. And so we're charged with making sure that money is spent through programs to serve the most clients possible. We also are fortunate at the state level to have some funding. And the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence has been very good about lobbying and making sure that that money is continuing to come and that there is increases in that. Then my role becomes one of the council members to work with the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute to determine where that funding should go. We're also hopefully going to be working soon on a state plan again to see, you know, what are the best practices across the state? How can we best serve victims and survivors?
Well, are you seeing changes at the state level when it comes to addressing the topic of domestic violence?
I would say yes, that we are. I would say when I first started in 1994, there was not many laws around domestic violence. There was no or minimal understanding of prevention and the importance of prevention. That's, again, and I keep saying Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence because they are so much the leaders, and I so appreciate the advocacy and support they provide to us as local programs. But it's so important, and Colleen has done an excellent job making sure prevention is at the forefront. But we've got to be doing as much prevention work as we do intervention work. And one of the projects that locally we did a few years ago is we took a park in a middle-class neighborhood that was very neglected, and we turned it around and we made improvements, and it became a safe, stable, and nurturing place for children in the neighborhood to come. And we know if we can provide those safe, stable places for children and for families, domestic violence will be decreased. So the messaging, if we can change the norms, the attitudes, the beliefs, the thinking around what is acceptable behavior and what is unacceptable. We did a skin-to-skin campaign at our local Marin General Hospital where we involved dads and male caregivers. And we said, you have as vital a role in making sure that children are safe and secure as the mother that just gave birth. So it's things like that. It's working in the schools and focusing on the bullying and the conflict resolution. And you know, a child that grows up in a violent home, if they've never been around nonviolence, they don't know. They don't know what's acceptable and unacceptable. They don't know that it's not okay to yell and scream at your, you know, siblings or at others on the playground, because that's what they've witnessed. And so we've got to stop it. We all have a responsibility to change the thinking around what domestic violence entails.
Mm-hmm. And when you speak about us all having a responsibility, what are some of the steps? I know I spoke a little bit about this earlier, but just that folks that are on the outside, what are steps that they can do to ensure that people are having a healthy, happy, safe life?
Well, you start with yourself. You make sure that you are happy and healthy, that you have good self-esteem. And if you have, maybe you had issues as a child, maybe you witnessed domestic violence, you were molested, you grew up in a violent home. And if those were never, you know, shared, if you never sought counseling for that and it's affecting you, get yourself into counseling. Then make sure that your family, you know, again, you are role modeling positive, nurturing relationships in everything you do, making sure that you're respectful of each other, that you're not rigid in your stereotypes and your thinking. And then that just continues to extend out in your workplace. If you're in a position of management, making sure the policies you have around nonviolence are in place and are implemented, not just in a notebook, but actually are looked at and used in our communities. Again, making sure that we have protections for everyone, that we're equitable in what we're doing and how we're working. And it can be a simple thing, carrying the hotline card, carrying information, knowing who your local domestic violence provider is. So if and when someone reaches out, you don't have to be that savior. All you have to do is say, look, when you're ready, again, when you're ready, here's somewhere that I know I have confidence can assist you, and leaving mm-hmm. it at that.
That's a good point, to just have that information on hand to hand out if you need to give it to somebody. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. So would you say overall, I mean, is Indiana coming to a place where, I mean, I know you said it's gotten better over the years, but is it to a place where it could be a leader in prevention?
In prevention, absolutely. We have done some phenomenal work in Indiana around prevention. There's a lot more that we can do and need to do. Unfortunately, a lot of times that comes back to funding. But yes, we have done an outstanding work around prevention. And that's the key. You know, if we can get past the what is domestic violence to what does a healthy relationship looks like? Let's not talk about domestic violence. You know, a lot of people know what it is. Let's talk about what's the positives. You know, how can we break that cycle? What can we do to keep the next generation from experiencing that abuse?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I just wonder how much information that a lot of people grew up with was from movies or books or family life, where it's like, this is how it is, and how to sort of to flip that narrative around.
That is absolutely the problem. And that's where, again, I go back to, if you have any access to a child that you can make a change, you need to talk to them. You need to have those conversations. What you see on TV, what you see streaming, what you see on social media, that is not what you should be, you know, how your relationship should be. This is how it should be. Role modeling for those kids, for those adults, for those teenagers. You know, we've got to verbalize it. They see so much, and we've got to take the time. Society is so busy and fast. We've got to take the time to sit down, have meals with our kids, you know, interact with them, find out what's going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So more talking and listening than just kind of going with the flow. Well, where else can people get help or services if they're curious?
They can call the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. They have a 24-hour line. They can get online. I can tell you domesticshelters.org has a really good website, as well as the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Both of them can direct and guide them to services. So it's just, you know, it's again, reaching out on if they do get online, there's always an escape button so they can quickly escape if they find that their abuser may be tracking them and it isn't safe for them to do that. Again, they can call Hands of Hope at any time and we can guide and direct them. Let them, you know, answer their questions.
Mm-hmm. And can you give us that number one more time before we wrap up?
765-664-0701.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Linda. It's been a pleasure to have you on and to give us all of this insight. Linda Wilk, Director of Hands of Hope, which is a division of Family Service Society Incorporated. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Kerman is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow to find out how the pandemic has impacted special education in Indiana. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.